Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. We're talking about the future of the classical music industry with some great guests. Thank you for joining us.
No matter where you are or who you are, music connects us all. We started with a dream, but now we are paving the future. Welcome to the Sound is Perceiva Global Competition. Fully virtual, yet bringing musicians closer together than ever before, now on a global scale. True live, inclusivity, diversity, connection, community, an extraordinary array of judges. Get noticed by companies all over the world. Prizes, scholarships, performance opportunities. Apply to be a part of the most exciting congregation of artists like nothing you've ever seen before. We guarantee quality and leave no musician behind. We can't wait to hear you on the virtual stage.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Music Works. And today I'm talking to Anna Uspenskaya from Virtual Concert Halls and Sound is Perceiva Global Competition. Hello, Anna.
Hi. Nice to see you again. That's nice a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Anna and I have been working together for a few months now, and Virtual Concert Halls is her startup, has been producing my podcast, so she's been in the background the whole time. So I'm really excited to have a conversation with you today. So why don't we start with, can you tell us a bit about Virtual Concert Halls?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Virtual Concert Halls was a startup company just 7 months ago. We started it as a group of four professional musicians. There was our response to concert venues and concert halls and our own seasons, postponing the concerts and then gradually closing and announcing that there is no more, at least until the summer. And granted, we were in a mode of hoping that this would be much shorter than it turned out to be. But we were not in the mode of expecting this situation to improve dramatically within a couple of weeks. And that gives us a perspective on putting our effort and looking into solutions. Of course, you know, getting into solutions for something is massive and something as disruptive is a mammoth task, which can be quite discouraging. So I think what gave us an enormous energy to move forward with our ideas was actually the premises of, okay, we're in this lockdown for longer than a couple of weeks. And as tragic and as painful as it felt at the beginning, it gave us this perspective and this look at the situation with a longer term in mind. And the beginning of that was the need to provide something for the students of Hunter Mill Music Studio. That's the music studio which I had been running for over 20 years. It's a private music studio, curriculum-based, small private music school just outside Washington, D.C. in the suburb of Vienna, Virginia. And we have several teachers working in here. It's not huge, but it's a very active and very well-organized music studio which provides comprehensive curriculum and includes regular performances. So in March, right in the middle of March, when we had to close our in-person classes and recitals, the first question which came up, what are we going to do with the recitals? Recitals are a major part of the curriculum and for all performing arts. Let's be frank about it. I'm a professional pianist. I should be well organized and well motivated. If I don't have a date coming up, I have a hard time practicing, getting up in the morning and doing whatever I need to do to learn the next set of repertoire. And demanding that from the kids and students is all but unreasonable. Everyone needs a goal. And in the performing arts, the goal is a performance. It's just clear as that. So my task as a leader of this small school, the Hunter Mill Music Studio, was how are we going to provide that goal to the students? We still had at least two sets of recitals left in the school year. And we do them involving judges. And that's an important part. The judges share their comments, and in the normal in-person situation, those are written comments. And each recital is planted at a specific place of the curriculum. So at the beginning of the year, even the newcomers of the studio, they have this comprehensive plan. They know what's going to happen in September recital, what's going to happen in October recital, and it's all dedicated to different parts of the education and styles of composition for piano or violin, cello. And it's all connected with their music history and music appreciation study and their theory and all of that. So it's interconnected curriculum. And the idea was, okay, we're in a bad enough situation, maybe we can just let our imagination roam unrestricted and come up with some crazy ideas. And the crazy idea was, let's do a virtual recital. Okay, at that time, I remember nobody was even talking about any virtual recitals. Zoom and other video calls were really not providing very good quality, and there was pretty much nowhere else to look, and people were not really even actively looking. Then there was a shift. People moved into trying to provide some sense of perspective and some sense of purpose to their students by recording their pieces and then combining them into a recording, which would be then uploaded to YouTube. And all four of us, the original co-founders of Virtual Concert Halls, now the company is much larger, of course, but all four of us felt kind of similarly about recording. We all had extensive recording experience as professional musicians, and none of us were particularly fond of that form of expression. There are definite benefits in doing the recordings. You have an opportunity to polish your performance, to perform, to play and record again and again, and to edit as a professional. You can edit extensively. You can even edit, you know, a little color of that note or this note in the recording. But and some people really like that kind of work. But all four of us felt similarly that this lacked this spontaneity and lacked some other communicative opportunities for musicians. So we felt strongly that the live performance is better suited for our own artistic goals. And that unity in opinion was also very helpful, because that gave us multiplied by four kind of energy. Let's look for a live performance other than looking into doing a recording. So we ruled out doing recordings for students right away and didn't even go that route. And then we started dreaming. How can we do that? How can we make it happen? Because at that time, we knew next to nothing about performing on a virtual platform. I think even those words were not part of our everyday language. Now they are. And then for a few weeks, we were researching the video calling platforms and systems. I want to say for 10, 12 hours a day, four of us. That's quite a bit of research. We got in touch with WebEx owners, and we tried to get in touch with just about everyone of them out there. I think I remember sending a dozen or more emails asking video call providers for some guidance, how we can transmit music in a better quality than the underwater sound of it. And most of them did not reply, but some of them did. And the feedback we got from them is, you're looking in the wrong place, because we are not designed for enhancement of the sound. We're designed for suppression of the sound. So basically, for those platforms to support what musicians are looking for would mean for them to rewrite their basic codes and principles behind their platforms. That was disappointing. It was a setback, which left us for a couple of weeks kind of feeling hopeless, because we didn't want to do it on Zoom. It just didn't sound like a worthy endeavor. And then we started looking in different other directions, and then started engaging more people and consultants and asking anyone and everyone were locked up. So people tended to answer our questions. And so we started gathering information and learning where to look for the right systems, the right platforms, and a big infusion of energy and expertise was when I myself and my husband, who is a cellist, got involved with the Kennedy Center. They were looking also for a way to transmit live performances and discussions. And so we worked very closely together with their tech team. And we were the first classical musicians on couch concerts. And it has the kind of pandemic flavor name, couch concerts. And that series of performances is ongoing. Kennedy Center, since they started, continue to do three of them per week. So that was very helpful because together with that team, we were able to investigate and explore and apply a lot more resources and information. And then we formed Virtual Concert Halls. Our inaugural performance was the students' performance. We produced 7 students' recitals, and 6 of them were involving the judges. And the last 7th one, the last one of that school year, happened in June. And that was a massive production. That's where we were already able to test the systems and our approach to the limits, because that production involved 56 individual performances from their own locations live. And these were combinations of live performances and demonstrations and pre-recorded videos. The whole scope of things which we're doing now as a virtual concert hall, the Halls company, and offer to our clients. Of course, we expanded, and that was our early experimentations. We expanded on it and created a whole system of troubleshooting and protocols to produce the events. So that's the beginning. And now 7 months fast forward, I believe we're one of the leaders in the industry because the amount of work it takes to develop the system, allowing musicians and music shows to be produced live with participants from different locations, is enormous. And I think we got lucky. We had time and we had motivation, and we were at the right time in the right place asking other people to pitch in with their expertise. And at that time, they were willing and they had time to do that. So that made it possible for just a normal musicians to develop something as complex and as comprehensive as Virtual Concert Hall's platform.
It's a fabulous platform. Yeah. It's very exciting to watch it develop and see where it's going.
Yeah, still developing.
Oh yeah, always. That's what it is to be an industry leader.
Yeah, yeah.
Always developing.
Always looking for what's out there new to improve, yeah.
And so the Soundless Percevo Global Competition is being run by Virtual Concert Halls and is an online competition, is that right?
Yep.
And why don't you tell us about that?
So this is more or less a logical continuation of the virtual recitals which we did at the very beginning. So the idea was an early on idea. If we can run successfully the judged recitals, it's just the next logical step. Let's do a competition. So we started working on the idea very early on, I want to say at the beginning of June. And it took about 4 months and a lot of people to formulate the concept and the details and the underlying principles of the competition. There are just so many aspects in the competition. And because we were not hired to produce this competition, we had no bosses and no deadlines and no requirements. We were doing it on our own time out of our own desire to create something. So we took time to look into every aspect, and we were like, okay, if we're doing something that new in terms of how we produce it, maybe we can just add some new life, infuse some new ideas into the concept itself. And so we approached a lot of musicians, our colleagues and strangers through different social networks. We connected with managers and concert producers and organizers and from different countries from all over the world. And it was really interesting to watch the competition take shape with all the expertise and suggestions which people were willing to share. And when those suggestions started pouring in, we realized that we need to take some time. So the competition concept was not ready until, I want to say, end of September. So we just released it at the end of September. I stopped counting how many people pitched in at 200. So I'm going to stick with the number 200, but it's more.
So it's been a real rethinking of the competition model, hasn't it? And that's, you know, it's encouraging to see, because it's one thing trying to replicate the music industry and performances and so on, but in an online format, and it's quite another to say, right, we're doing this differently, so let's do it differently. Let's do it how we want to do it. So what are the main things, like key points about the competition that are different from the kind of standard classical competition, would you say?
Sure, yeah. So I think maybe it's important for me to trace back a little bit and give the reasoning behind those principles. And so the competition was created out of desire to create something which we would like. Simple as that. As professional musicians, all of us had gone through excessive competing. And later on, we all had gone through judging competitions and through preparing students for competitions. So that kind of encompasses all aspects of the process of a competition, doing it to yourself, judging it, and preparing younger musicians for it. And the dissatisfactions are very specific. It's not a general disenchantment with a competition as a concept itself. That's what we found with ourselves and majority of people who we consulted with. It's very specific and a very precise dissatisfaction with certain aspects of how competitions run in general. So we decided to just address those, because if the competition was providing an opportunity for musicians in a way which would encourage the creativity and would promise that individuality would be respected and appreciated, then we felt like we might enter a competition ourselves. So the simple solution to that was, let's create a competition which we would like to enter. And our co-founders, the team of Virtual Concert Halls, consists of musicians of different generations, which also is very helpful. So two of us, me and my husband, we are middle-aged musicians, and then Fyodor Uspensky and Frany Rusinovich are musicians from a completely different generation, in their 20s. So their input was very, very interesting and pointed us in the directions which we probably otherwise would not look in. So now coming to the nuts and bolts of it, what is it musicians don't like about competing? First of all, we don't like to be told what to play. We don't like to be told how long to play. And we absolutely dread being stopped in the middle of our performance. So these were easy fixes. The Soundist Perceiver competition, first of all, will not stop anyone. Will not prescribe how long your program is going to be. And will not impose on you which pieces to choose to play. As professional musicians, when we get out of the age of competing, it's a big like, thank God, I don't have to play this plus that plus that in that order, because someone decided that's a reasonable order. I can base my presentation, my program, on what represents me as an artist best. Now, that requires self-reflection and self-reflection. Let's put it simply, for the artist. And that immediately point us in the direction of education, music education. Music education in general is not too self-reflective. It's a lot about meeting certain standards and proving yourself as an educated someone who knows what those standards are and knows how to meet them. And it's good for basic study of very, very basics, maybe. But I still want to put a maybe on top of it, because even the basic technique, if it's in a disconnect from respect and appreciation and encouragement of personal reflection and personal expression, it becomes a drag for students. Anyone who ever taught students heard those students saying, well, that's utterly boring. And it is utterly boring unless it's connected with the emotional expression of that particular person on their particular level and on their terms. So the competition, the Sound is Perceived competition, decided to provide the platform for that. Down to earth, everyone will choose their own repertoire. Everyone will choose their own length of the program. And everyone will be judged based on their terms. And we're not going to stop anyone. That's just an atrocity of modern world of efficiency and economy. I understand efficiency and economy, but those don't apply to art. I'm sorry. They just don't. And so stopping someone in the middle of the Beethoven sonata is just a plain atrocity, because you are interrupting not only the young person who has something to say at the end, you're interrupting a masterpiece of world music and culture, and it just sends a wrong message of disrespect. And it just confirms that you don't really need to understand how the novel ends to be able to judge it. You don't need to read what the writer said at the end, the punchline at the end, and you can judge a novel, a classic novel, based on that. It's just the wrong message.
I think the habit of stopping people mid-audition or mid-competition, it implies that, essentially if the first note or phrase isn't perfect, then that's just not good enough. And there isn't, things change during performances, things happen, musicians are always adapting and changing. And, I just think that not allowing that to happen, it must have an impact on the whole performance, as I'm sure this is your point, is that, if you think you might be stopped, surely you're giving the whole performance with a sort of sense of, ooh, better get it all out there straight away in case, in case I don't get to the end.
Exactly. It sets a parameter for preparation to the competition focused on the first phrase or first however long until you get stopped. So it sets a parameter away from the art, which is the expression and the message, into the realm where you have to prove your mechanical knowledge or mechanical ability or whatever it is. And the other really confusing and disheartening thing is, who are the judges? You are proving some kind of standard and you're limited to unfinished presentation because you'll be stopped. And you need to read the mind of certain people who are going to be judging you on incomplete performance. This is just absurd. It's an absurd concept. And I can totally understand how we got here. But, because competitions didn't used to do that. Competitions didn't used to stop or even prescribe very restrictive repertoire at the beginning when the competition started as a big enterprise in early 20th century. They were not doing it. But I totally understand how the economy and the process and the practicality of things got us there where we are now with the competitions. But it doesn't make bad practices into good practices, understanding the underlying reasons for that. Still, the change is important and needed. And the virtual platform being so accessible for both judges and contestants and everyone, just provided that opportunity. for us to try it out. Because if you tell musicians you can play as long as you want, someone might play for an hour and a half. Now, if you are running your competition at Carnegie Hall, you're paying $5,000 and up per hour. What if that person who decided to present an hour and a half program really overestimated their ability? And you are presenting an hour and a half at $7,500 and cost, and you're really not presenting a worthy performance. That can happen too. So that is a possibility which physical concert halls and managers who produce competitions in those venues just can't afford, and that's totally understood. However, the virtual platform gives a freedom to be able to produce that kind of environment, because if someone decided to play for an hour and a half and they really don't know what they're doing, all the viewers can log off. They're not captives of this program. They're not in the chair. They can, they're not locked in that hall sitting through an hour and a half of unpleasant performance. So the risk is much lower.
And it puts the impetus on the contestant to choose what's best for them. I mean, I'm assuming that you would go so far as to say that applying to the competition and then giving an hour and a half's performance is probably not the best idea.
If I were doing it, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because on the back of my mind, I would think, well, what if I bore everyone to death with my gorgeous, wonderful presentation, and then someone comes in with equally gorgeous, wonderful presentation, but only for about 15 minutes?
Yeah.
I lost.
Just, what a lot of effort. But practically speaking, but it means that people have to think about these things for themselves and think about what they're most comfortable with. I'm struck in my work as a looking after musicians, I'm often struck by how far people can get in their careers without feeling truly confident that the decisions that they make about their own playing and what they're presenting are the best decisions. And people need a lot of help with that. And it's not to say that they should just wake up one day and be like, I'm going to do this and this is my thing and that's my career all made now, done and dusted. But to have really, established professional musicians asking me what they should put on a website repertoire list, I just think, well, I don't know. And I just find myself always saying, you should put on it what you want to play. And then people get worried that if they don't put the famous concerto for their instrument on, or that people will think they can't play it. And, maybe some people will think that, but they shouldn't think that. Being selective does not mean being incapable. And it's all ingrained in the way we're educated, isn't it? So when we do exams as children, we have to do like a piece from each era and, have to show the wide range. There's nothing so much wrong with that as an educational tool, but that point at which we get to make our own decisions and say, I am this artist and this is my niche and this is what I want to convey to people. I feel like that's very, very difficult for musicians to identify that moment between being the student that has to comply with what a teacher thinks they need to do and being the performer that says, this is what I'm doing. I feel as though that's not a clear transition for people.
This is a very strong point and an extremely important point, Katie, because our music education has solidified as a academic topic. In other words, the approach to educating people in music is very academic, which really completely shifts everything from subjective to objective. So every time students learn music, they have to be compliant. That's the premises. That's the environment of it. So they have to be compliant with the score, they have to be compliant with the fingering, they have to be compliant with the teacher's instruction, they have to be compliant with the phrasing which is written in there, and compliant. And this has not been the case in the history of the art, and now this is the prevalent approach. However, it's a dead-end approach, because compliance is not where the art is. It's just the wrong place to produce the art. So by engaging the students from early on, all through their study, in the compliance mode, we are basically teaching them that the art comes from a place where it does not exist. The art comes from subjectivity, and it is a language of subjectivity. So is it possible to teach people to be subjective in their music making from the early on? Absolutely. There are plenty of pedagogical theses and techniques and methods which teach just that. You don't have to grow out of diapers and graduate from your college or wherever you go to apply creative approach to learning music. You can do it from day one. You can do it with a five-year-old. However, the prevalent methods and systems are not based on that. So that's how you get end up with the professional musicians who don't know what repertoire is good to put on their website, because all they learned throughout their life is their repertoire and their approaches to their artistry has to satisfy outside objective standard. So when they are faced with the question, which repertoire to put on the website, their immediate thinking is what other people are going to think about it, which is a fundamentally anti-creative approach. Because the convincing artist is the artist who can convince others in what they think, not please Absolutely. Other people's opinion.
And it's the constant conundrum, isn't it, of wanting to... Musicians seem to simultaneously want to be part of the tradition, which means I'm a concerto violinist, so what do I therefore put on my website so that I fit in with all the other concerto violinists? And simultaneously, you have to stand out from all the others so that you get the gig.
Oh, that's such an easy question. Yeah. To stand out from the entire gig and to satisfy tradition. It's the easiest answered and the easiest question of all, because to be a good violinist you have to be, or pianist, you have to be someone with curiosity. Yes. And what does curiosity drive you to do? Learn as many concertos as possible, because you're curious about them, because you want to play them your way. And then where does curiosity take you further? Well, there are some concertos which had not been performed. What are those? How do they sound? And there are some concertos which were just composed. And there are some composers which are so interesting. I want them to write a concerto for me. There you go. Your list of concertos will never be like someone else's if you only learned to follow your own curiosity, your own personal drive. That's the only premises.
That's solved.
The problem solved. Yeah. Same goes for the rest of the repertoire. There's vast ocean of the repertoire. I honestly, based on personal choice and based on the respect of personal choice and respect of your own personality, I have no idea how can anyone come up with the same list of pieces on their website as someone else. It's just not possible.
Yeah.
Unless you're prescribed a certain number of pieces in certain styles to satisfy certain milestones in your career. Well, you can satisfy those same milestones of your career without doing that. You can still, I'm sure every pianist in the world likes at least one Beethoven sonata, at least one Bach fugue. Well, put those on your repertoire. Don't put everything else.
Every single one, yeah.
So for the sound is presio, that's another underlying message which we want to send to the music community. It's time to rethink those things, because if Mozart was following principles of compliance, where would he be?
What a thought.
And he had a phenomenal teacher who based his teaching, Leopold Mozart. He even wrote, you know... he even wrote about his pedagogical principles. And his principles were just that. Energize the curiosity, energize exploration, and feed both. with knowledge and skill of the previous generation, which is that tradition. You feed the tradition to the person so that they can digest it and use the previously created tools to express their own current individuality.
I absolutely agree. That's and is that what we're going to find from the judges in the competition then, an understanding of individuality and curiosity? And
interesting question. We had a concern that maybe we're just outliers and not many people are sharing our views. And it was almost like a floodgate went open. Because when we started talking to our colleagues and offering them to join the competition as the judges, it was incredible. When we were describing the principles behind the competition and how we're going to run it, to summarize, the response was, "You really are going to do that? OMG, I am in." Yeah. That was a general response, because it was almost like we gave the voice to everybody's shared impression, understanding, and desire. We just formulated and gave it voice, which was not listened to or heard. I'd rather say that maybe it was not articulated as well as we did in the Sounders Perceiver. Not to say that we did it very well, but at least we made an attempt. For instance, we created the categories based on artistic merit and based on artistic areas of expression. And there are 9 categories, and don't expect musicians to be divided by whether they're playing flute or double bass. Because we wanted to create the categories which would give the judges and the audience and the musicians a guidance into something which can be equally applied across instruments, first of all. At the same time, was broad enough to give people room to maneuver maneuver their repertoire choices and their preparation. At the same time, would be clear enough to actually define the categories. So this was a pretty challenging task. And so we defined them based on personal experiences, which many of us had, judging competitions. And I'll tell you, you'll laugh about it, because you probably heard that from other people. So when I'm sitting on the judges panel, one of the things I always dread most is the discussion. If the judges are even allowed to discuss anything. In many competitions, that completely done with. History. Judges are not allowed to discuss because for some odd reason, music community doesn't trust the judges to be fair and to be decent, and expects that if judges discuss, then one is going to try to influence the others in favor of their favorite whoever. In other words, corruption, assumption that people are corrupt is also there. We can just imagine it's not there, but a lot of people are afraid of competitions being corrupt. And there is corruption present there. But the bigger problem is, to me, and a lot of my colleagues actually agree with it, strangely enough, is that even when people are not acting based on corruption and they're not trying to pull someone through the competition so their colleagues or their friend student wins the prize, even when people are not trying to do any of that, even when people are coming to the competition panel with the best intention and putting their absolute best effort, it still collapses. Discussions collapse. So the managers found a solution. Okay, discussions collapse, let's chop that. No more discussions. And then we are relying on algorithms and we're inputting numbers. And that is very unartistic approach, uncreative approach. So, and how do the discussions collapse? Because we start talking about the contestant A or contestant X, whatever that contestant is. And within the first minute, if not sooner, the discussion veers away from the performance, from the contestant, and goes into general terms of what's important in the artistry in general. We like to generalize things, right? So what's more important, virtuosity, grandeur, or lyricism? And for some odd reason, don't ask me why, a lot of times people juxtapose those as though it's one or another. And then we just bump heads. What's more important, taking a new look at the old piece of music or adhering with the most authentic publication of that piece? So we start bumping heads on those, and we forgot all about the particular performance of that particular contestant. We're not judging the contestant anymore. We are engaging in tug of war of who can convince whom of their principle of authenticity, vice versa lyricism, vice versa virtuosity, which one of those is more important. So in the Sound is Perceivable, we decided to take a very unconventional approach and group the judges who believe in one of those being the most important into a panel which is going to judge those of the contestants who believe the same thing is the most important. In other words, we have virtuosity as a category. Virtuosity satisfies all of those requirements because you can be virtuoso on the flute as well as virtuoso on the double bass, as well as on the trumpet, as well as on the harp, as well as on the guitar, and as well as a singer. You can be virtuoso in all of those. And it's kind of obvious. If you're a pianist, you can notice if someone is a virtuoso violinist. At least I believe professionals can. So, at the same time, some people believe virtuosity is the forefront. It's the most important thing. It's the most impressive, and they thrive in that environment. Some professional musicians are virtuosos primarily, and everything else as a secondary. And they choose their repertoire that way. They play Paganini because they love the virtuosity. And some contestants may feel the same way. Granted, music cannot be only fast. And you'll have beautiful lyrical phrase inside the caprices by Paganini. But this is more about the focus as opposed to elimination one in favor of another.
I understand, yeah. So it's not all of the categories or the qualities are going to be present in every performance. But what you've done is you've got people together who for whom virtuosity is the key or for whom lyricism is the key. And that's the thing that they want people to be listening for.
Yes. Being academic and authentic is the key. Granted, it comes with both virtuosity and lyricism, but authenticity is probably a lot more important to those people who play period instruments, because they just love to dig out the beauty which was produced then at that time, and you know they have a ton of good reasons for loving that style. So we would like to invite them and be part of the competition and feel comfortable that they're not going to be judged on comparing their approach to someone who is playing an electric violin.
Yeah, because those really are two different genres. Because the university that I went to was very focused on historically informed performance of Baroque music, and as a singer in particular, there was very clear, almost like institutional style of how these things were performed, and it didn't suit my voice very well, mm-hmm. which cost me opportunities. It cost me soloist opportunities, and in the wider industry, there's nothing remotely outlandish about the way I sing Bach, I can assure you. But in that particular context, it had an enormous impact on my ability to get what I wanted out of my degree and out of the performance opportunities that were available during mm-hmm. my degree. And so I can really, you know, I imagine that if you have a virtuosity and an authenticity, a category that Handel, for instance, may well appear in both as a singer, that they would be presumably judged in a completely different way.
Yes, and that's the idea, to be judged on your own terms. And contestants can declare where they want to be nominated. And declaration of, I want to be nominated in a Swift category or a Music Ambassador category doesn't automatically get you nominated. The judges will ultimately decide whether to nominate. But even just giving people a voice to declare where they want to be gives the judges a perspective on that. If someone wants to be nominated in academic category, it's not the same thing as being nominated as a music ambassador, for example. And the music ambassador category, for instance, is one where a lot of musicians feel they fit. At the same time, they feel like that's a secondary, maybe I should be going in there because I may be judged for being less of the high-level musician if I do that. What I'm talking about is things like lecture recitals and things like performing with the candlelight, ornamenting your performance with environment, with the verbal supplement, with the visual supplements, that kind of stuff. And by some of the musicians of my generation, at least, a musician doing that could be very harshly criticized based on, well, you can't play well enough, so you need candles. And that judgment...
Because candles are so helpful.
Well, in some environments, to some musicians. So not to say that everyone should put the candles on or have a wine sitting on their piano. It's just to give podium, to give a platform for different kind of expression. And I remember being in Moscow Conservatory as a kid in the school where things were very traditional and very prescriptive. And, well, I shouldn't badmouth my school because obviously I'm a product of that school in many ways. So progressive thinking and thinking outside the box was encouraged too, I have to say that. But anyway, I remember attending a concert of a pianist who actually did that. He supplemented his performances. He was a classical pianist with all kinds of visuals and talk and act. So his concerts were set in a more like a theater play presentation style. And I absolutely loved it. To me, that was where I felt comfortable, where I felt my place would be. I wanted to do my concerts that way. And I remember a total dread of even admitting that I went to one of those concerts. Not to do them, but to observe. Because the general culture at the time in the Soviet Union was, this is a lower kind of art. You don't do that if you're doing pure art. Maybe you don't. But is it a powerful form of art? Absolutely. Now we're fast forward many years.
It's one of the fundamental flaws with how classical music is going, or has been going, isn't it? Because if you can't pay attention to the fact that different settings and different circumstances make different people feel more comfortable or enjoy it more, then you can't appeal to anything other than a very narrow audience base.
Exactly.
So it's no wonder that classical music appears niche when we're told this as musicians, when we're told that you're only allowed to enjoy it in a certain way.
Yeah, well, we basically painted ourselves in the corner by doing that.
Yeah.
In a very, very tight corner. So the Soundist Perceiver competition is a first one. Maybe we'll do more, hopefully. But the idea behind every aspect of it is let's paint ourselves out of that corner. Because we are all suffocating in it, us musicians and managers and the audience. We all feel suffocated in that corner. And let's just listen to the voices of everyone. Everyone wants broader, more freedom and more variety and more acceptance. Everybody wants that. Let's create it.
Absolutely. And I just want to ask one last question, which is about the impact of the competition on the contestants, because we know, we've discussed before, that competitions in general are a big part of the marketplace and the, essentially the job market for classical music. And I have lots of views on that as a promoter. But I would love to hear how you, your take on that issue and how you've addressed that with this competition.
Mm-hmm. So the idea was, there are other industries out there which conduct their competitions, maybe in a good way or in some good ways, which can be adopted, which we can learn and apply. And one of very successful forms of event in many other industries is job fair or industry fair. Fantastic platform for companies, new, old, alike, with new products or old products, reinvented products, whatever those companies in that particular industry are doing. It's an extraordinary opportunity for people to come to a place and to do what? To find partners, to show what you got, to see what other people got, to get hired, to hire, and so forth. Those are extraordinary pockets of energy and future work for everyone. So in the Sound is Perceived competition, we wanted to recreate some of the best practices of a job fair and create an environment in which contestants can make contact with the promoters, promoters can make contact with the contestants, and promoters and both can make contact with each other and find more energy and more people to continue with their own projects. So instead of handing out prizes, prescription sounds like a CVS. So getting away from a pharmacy around your corner, we decided to liberate managers from a big turn off from participating in the competitions and offering prizes to musicians. The big turn off for managers is you have to sign up and commit to promoting a winner. Now that a winner is decided by a handful of people, not to say anything bad about those people, but coming back to even being on your best footing and judging the competition, it's very difficult to pick the best because of the way competitions are set up. So the managers are putting a lot of resources of their company in the hands of a few judges who are going to decide the recipient. And then sometimes it's just a matter of luck. Sometimes you end up signing up an artist which is suitable to your particular company and your style of work. Other times you end up being committed to promoting an artist which doesn't fit your company's style and your venues you work with, but you're committed. So what happened in the past 60, 40, 50 years, a lot of management companies pulled away from the competitions and stopped offering prizes because being locked in that deal before knowing who that prize winner is going to be is inconvenient, to say the least. So what we did with the Sound is Perceived competition, we offered promoters to be their own judges of the competition and the contestants and offer the prizes to those contestants who fit their particular company, because each management company also has individual unique abilities and limitations. And then we also offered the management companies not to precisely outline the prize, because if you get away from, kind of turn away from objectivity in the arts and embrace subjectivity of the arts, then a prize needs to be tailored towards the artist. Some artists are suitable for this kind of promotion, Other artists are suitable for a completely different kind of promotion. What is a good manager? Good manager is not someone who creates a one-size-fits-all package. Even the word package doesn't sit very well when connected with a performing artist. It's not a package. It's a person. So a good manager is a flexible one who looks at the individual abilities of the artists they sign in, and they work individually with that artist to promote them the best way that talent can be promoted. So we gave the managers room to not only pick the recipients, but to tailor in the end the prizes which they're going to offer to those contestants, tailored to the individual contestant, of course, within, you know, within the company's scope, whatever that company is doing, but gave those keys to the managers themselves, because we believe in the end managers do hold those keys, even if you lock them with handcuffs to your competition, they're gonna wiggle out of it because it's just an unsustainable model to keep people captive.
I mean, if things aren't working, it's not good for either party to keep trying to make them work, is it?
And it's not sustainable.
No, exactly. And I just think this is what this means to me, is that you're creating a competition in which people present themselves in their best possible light with their own choice and everything available to them. They can't essentially lose. There don't appear to be any losers in this competition.
No, they can't lose.
You get to tailor yourself to what you think your best performance will be, and as a result, your prize will be tailored to you as well. And the whole thing is all about the individual nuances of what makes a musician really tick, what makes a musician-manager relationship really tick, what makes a performance really tick. And it feels highly, highly refreshing to me to have those things at the forefront of something that is essentially geared towards musicians getting hired. Because what we see all the time is brilliant people win competitions, and then that goes at the top of the CV. And then when managers are faced with, or promoters in particular, are faced with booking a performance from this person or this person, and the competition at the top wins the place, and then there's a whole load of people for whom the competition wasn't tailored, who are just as viable artists, who just don't get the same amount of notice. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, to say anything negative about the winners of any competition, because they are wonderful. I just feel that there are so many wonderful people who are in or on the edges of the musician world, and it's made so much more difficult for them if the way they're measured and the way they're judged doesn't suit them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And what I believe also is there's another side of the problem. The performance venues and concert halls and season providers and all that, first of all, they are not overbooked. There's a disconnect between places where the concerts can happen and where there is a desire of people to have classical musicians come and perform, and the musicians and the managers. There is a disconnect in there. There's many more, just like you said, musicians who can provide phenomenal experience to the audience through their performances, who don't get hired. And there's phenomenal, just as impressive amount of concert halls which are not booked. And there's just as phenomenal number of vast slices of the society of people who would like to listen to the concert, but they don't get a chance. So those things need to be better connected. And by providing the sound is perceived, by tailoring sound is perceived more like a, let's say, combination between job fair and Grammy nominations, we're trying to create the environment where initiative can feel welcome and appreciated. So hopefully there will be more projects coming out of it.
I'm sure. And it's really come through, like you said, with the people, the reaction of people when they get involved. It's, you know, there's just a real warmth about the whole thing, which I'm absolutely certain will be the absolute key to shaping the participants' experience. But even just as a collaborator on the project, I feel that with everything that I'm involved in, that kind of always remembering why we're doing it and why it's important and what's really, you know, making it special. So
thank you, Katie. I feel warm and fuzzy about it. I never felt like that about any competition.
Yeah. Really warm and fuzzy, and competitions not too together usually, are they really? So could you just tell us, and I think there'll be a promotional video for the competition as well, if you could just tell us how people can apply.
So that process is more or less standard, so people can go on the competition website, virtualconcerthalls.com, and just simply click on the apply and go through the application, which is not extensive. They can choose categories, or they can skip choosing that. They can provide information about their teachers and schools, and the information, if they do provide it. We post the teachers and the schools on the Sounders Perceiver website, because we believe it's not just a formal nod. We believe contestants really do represent their institutions, and we will be inviting their teachers and our representatives of their schools to our podcast and asking them hard questions about where our industry is going. How do they see it from where they are? So when contestants provide this information, then they need to sign a couple of forms, very common forms, and then just pay the application fee. And they can apply by November 15th. They will need to take live, private, preliminary audition, and it's made private. To protect the contestants from potential embarrassment if they happen to overestimate their basic proficiency on the instrument, which we haven't had any. We already had quite a number of people applying, and we already auditioned quite a few, and the level is impressive. It seems like people do feel more of a permission to express themselves. We had a couple of really wild performances. People played newly written music.
Brilliant.
As in 4 weeks ago written. And that was really interesting. And so not to give out too much information about it, but just a little peek preview. So
well, thank you so much for telling us about it. Really excited to watch it. It's all going to be broadcast live, right?
Yes. Nominations round, which is like a semifinal, and the final round are both going to be public broadcast, and they are going to be organized more or less like a television show. The contestants, if they are comfortable with it, will have an opportunity to be interviewed after the performance. And the judges will be connected to the live broadcast and will be giving their comments in real time immediately after the performance. Now, the decisions will be made collegiately after each session. Each session, probably about an hour and a half, 2 hours of music. And then the judges will elaborate and deliberate. And during the deliberations, we will be interviewing contestants' parents, if that's a kid, contestants' teachers, representatives of schools, contestants' supporters. They might have donors and sponsors who are sponsoring their study. We would like to welcome those people too. We'll be asking them questions. This will be conducted as a community event with lots of people involved. We want to represent and showcase different aspects of the industry and different aspects, different people who are inputting energy into this. Wonderful. And then the judges will come in and announce the results. And the finals round will take place over 9 days, because we have 9 categories. Each day we'll be broadcasting one category, we'll be focused on one. As I said, the panel of judges will be those who chose to judge that particular category and the contestants which were nominated for that category. So that's focused on one day. And then there will be a gala, winner's gala, with prizes and more interviews and more social gathering. And so.
Fantastic. Can't wait. Thank you so much, Anna. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Kitty, for having me and giving me an opportunity to talk about the competition. This is just wonderful what you created, this platform and this outlet for musicians to talk about what they're doing.
Thank you so much.
Great job.
It's been such a pleasure.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening today. To find out what we're up to, do join our mailing list or follow us on social media. And if you'd like to support the podcast by buying me a coffee, you can do that on buymeacoffee.com. Thank you so much. See you next time.